This episode is brought to you in part by the American Homebrewers Association, a community of more than 40,000 fermentation enthusiasts from around the world. Visit homebrewersassociation.org for recipes, brewing tips, and conversation. That's homebrewersassociation.org. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, February 6th, 2020. I'm James Spencer, and I don't know what time it is. I don't know what day it is. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, the second part of my chat with Chris Nogi as we sample beers from Whistling Springs Brewing Company, a fun little brewery producing tasty beers in the country, just over the border into Missouri. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. And if you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And big thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of the stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Financial supporters have already seen the video that I'm planning to post publicly this Friday, and that's the episode that we did with Steve's Smoky Pale Ale Yeast Experiment. Steve is great at brewing smoky beers, and it was fun to taste the effect of a pale ale yeast and a Belgian yeast on those beers. And those yeast strains came from our friends and sponsors at Imperial Organic Yeast, by the way. A couple of days ago, I kegged my Dark Maibock, brewed with the current seasonal strain from Imperial, L09 Que Bueno. It's a versatile lager strain known for its crisp and dry finish. Que Bueno has a very clean, low ester profile that they say is great for Mexican lagers, hence the name, but it's appropriate for any lager that you want to be clean and delicious. My Maibock came out malty and really tasty and clean. The fermentation was clean, low esters. After about a week of cold crashing, Que Bueno just got out of the way and flocculated very well. And so I racked a nice, clean, clear beer into my keg. I've got ingredients for a black lager that I hope will be equally as malty and delicious. You know we love Imperial Organic Yeast. They've got the highest cell count at 200 billion cells in easy-to-open packages. My stir plate is dusty because I don't use it anymore for moderate gravity 5-gallon batches. Imperial has excellent quality control and customer support. You can always depend on delicious results. L09 Que Bueno will be available until the end of February, so get with your local homebrew store and ask for Imperial Organic Yeast. Let's look into the mailbag. Walter from Basking Ridge, New Jersey writes, I have a beer that has a good bitterness and no off flavors, but is lacking somewhat on the flavor and aroma end. So I was thinking to add a little punch with some dry hops. I have an assortment of hops, a Medusa, Azaka, Pecco, Cashmere, and Amarillo. I haven't dry hopped with any of them. Walter says, so it's time to experiment. I'm going to break my 5-gallon batch into 5 1-gallon kegs. Alpha acid percentage on these range from 3.6 to 18.5. I like your hop sampler approach where you adjust the hop additions based on relative alpha acid percentage. Walter says, my question is, what would your approach be if these hops were only added as dry hops at room temperature? Dry hopping is supposed to be about flavor and aroma, not alpha acid isomerization. Should I look to another parameter in order to equalize each hop's impact? Well, thanks, Walter. I punted this one. I forwarded it to Scott Janish of Sapwood Cellars, you know, because we've been talking a lot about hops lately. Scott says, you are right that dry hopping is more about flavor and aroma and less about bitterness, but dry hopping can impart some bitterness as well. High alpha acid hops can also come with more polyphenol content, which can impact the vegetal-like bitterness, but shorter dry hop durations can help with that. Scott says, but it's easy to make things too complicated. I would suggest dry hopping each 1 gallon with the hops that you are the most excited about based on their descriptions. For 1 gallon, I would probably start with 1.5 to 2.5 ounces of dry hops. A couple of days of contact time is about all you should need. So appreciate that, Scott. And Walter, I'd love to hear how that split batch experiment turns out. It sounds like a lot of fun. Great news from our friends and sponsors, Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. They've added an option to get a 15-gallon spike kettle with their 240-volt Warthog Bruna bag electric system. Now, this is the system that I have and love. You can customize your system at highgravitybrew.com. You can choose the 44 or 62-quart Bayou Classic kettle. I have the 62-quart. Now, you can get the 15-gallon spike kettle or a 15- or 22-gallon brew-built kettle. So you can go all the way from, 44 quarts to 22 gallons. Of course, there's different pricing on each option, so check highgravitybrew.com for details. You can also choose the type of power cord and length. Not to brag, but I have a very long cord, so I can brew in the kitchen, on the patio, or in the garage. The system is designed to be used with the Warthog EBC-130 controller, but if you can opt out if you already have a controller. You can also choose whether or not to get a pump if you already have one of those. So not only do you get a ton of flexibility in the way that you brew with the Warthog Brew-in-a-Bag system with the 240-volt system, you get a ton of options in how you order one. And if you use the code EBC75BB, you can save $75 off your electric brewing purchase. So take the pain out of propane with a new electric system from family-owned and operated HighGravityBrew.com. Now, in a previous interview a couple weeks ago, I talked to Chris Nogi about the gluten-free beers of Dark Hills Beer Company. Now we switch gears and talk about Whistling Springs, which shares a tasting room with Dark Hills. Well, Chris Nogi, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Well, I'm glad to be back. Glad you decided to spend some time on the other half of the tap wall.
Yeah, if you're just stumbling into this episode, listen to the previous one where we sat and talked about Dark Hills Brewing Company, or brewery, which is gluten-free and shares a tap room, not a brewing space, for obvious reasons, probably. Where are we?
the mailing address is Seligman, but we're actually in a little unincorporated area of Missouri called Jacket, about 1.5 miles north of the Arkansas state line, just outside of Pea Ridge.
Okay. And it's really a cool, quaint place, and it feels like it's in the middle of nowhere, even though it's, half an hour from bustling Northwest Arkansas, which is, a crazy place nowadays, growing by leaps and bounds.
Lots of folks just like that.
But here we are out in the country, and we got horses, we got pigs walking around. Yeah. We got a pond, we got dirt road, we got... It is a place to kind of get away and forget the more modern world for just a little bit.
Absolutely. You have to really want people to find you out here. And we really want people to find us out here. But you can come out and just enjoy the company of folks. We don't have a bunch of sports playing on TVs. We don't, this is a place where people can get together with their friends. It's family friendly. On Sundays, Summer, the daughter of the property owners here, she offers trail rides and beginning riding lessons for children and adults. And Sundays are our root beer float days, so non-alcoholic root beer, it's a good thing. We've got games, and like I said, we've got animals everywhere. It's kind of an amazing place to be. It's different than any other brewery in the area or any place else I've been. And we like keeping it that way.
Now, you mentioned the root beer, and I'm sipping on that, and it is delicious. So you got to talk about the root beer.
Okay. Sassy's root beer came out of the desire of our then 5-year-old son to have the best root beer in the world. And if you can't trust a 5-year-old to tell you when it's not the best, because they don't really care about hurting your feelings. So he kept saying, no, it needs this, it needs this, it needs this. And by the time he was, well, last year when he turned 10, we had him start brewing with us on the root beer side, because he finally decided that this was the root beer. And right after he decided that, we sent it off to the U.S. Open in 2019, and in July we received word back that we'd won bronze in the non-alcoholic root beer category, a huge category. Lots of people entering. A lot of breweries are starting to move to a few craft sodas in there with their beers, because the equipment's common for a lot of it, and the processing equipment is very common, you know. Either filtering, cold crashing, force carbonating, it's all something you already have. So you just have to work out some recipes. This is a true sassafras root beer. Back in the early 70s, there was a scare that nobody knew, but they claimed that safrol and sassafras would cause cancer. And so there was a parts per million limit, then a ban, and all kinds of weird things. And like so many of that, it's kind of gone by the wayside. Now it's all up in the air. It cures every cancer. It causes every cancer. It's known to the state of California to destroy the state of California. It's whatever anybody wants to think. But we use a safrol-removed sassafras in our root beer, along with a natural alcohol-free vanilla and pure sugar. No high fructose corn syrups or things like that. And we stick to it fairly simple. A lot of the things that we do, we try to make it, coming from last week's side, from the from the gluten-free side, there are a lot of folks out there who have concerns about what they put in their body. And if we can source things that people are just naturally more comfortable with, we became sensitive to all these things because we were dealing with celiac sufferers, not just people who wanted to be gluten-free for whatever reason, but true people who got sick from it. We became very sensitive to folks having real reasons for wanting the purest and cleanest and non-additive ingredients. And so we get those wherever we can.
So it's root beer. Typically, if you look at the ingredients on soft drink cans, root beer is typically the highest in sugar, by far. This one does not taste too sweet. I mean,
it's root beer.
Well, a lot of root beers do taste so sweet, and this one is nicely balanced.
We're a little bit closer to your average cola in sugar levels. The biggest change we've made over the last year is trying to adjust the sugar level to various things, because folks bring their kids in here and the kids are drinking glass after glass of root beer. And at some point in time, we had to say it suffered because we didn't have enough. And brought it up to the point where just a few people we knew were going to started saying, hey, that might be just... It's like, oh, don't worry about it. Just give them one glass.
Moderation.
Yeah, exactly. Because the quality of the product has to be in its balance. And that's the big thing, I think, that we noticed when our son was nixing recipes, is that we were trying to go forward with a certain flavor, and I was like, where's the rest? It doesn't have enough sugar. It doesn't have enough this. The carbonation's too low, this and that. Finally, we just decided to back off and see if we could put everything together and not worry about the numbers too much. Just come up with a really balanced thing. And it turned out to be in the ballpark of regular sodas for calorie count and carbs and things like that. We were kind of stunned that we pulled a bronze because... when the safrol thing happened, most root beer companies went to wintergreen as the flavor base for their root beers. And they share a lot of common qualities, sassafras and wintergreen, but there are very noticeable differences. And the judges have grown up since the 70s with wintergreen root beers. Mm-hmm. So the fact that a sassafras root beer actually pulled bronze and a wintergreen pulled gold was a little, we were a little shocked by it. Huh. We were expecting to get some good feedback and to be able to say we entered our product in this. And when it came back, wait a second, that's a sassafras root beer. How did that happen? Because most people aren't used to that. And I've had more people say, you know, I don't like root beer, but I like this one.
Well, I'm switching gears.
Yes.
From the root to the real. Mm-hmm. What am I sipping on here?
That would be our Veterans Triple X. This is the only not craft beer on our wall.
Why do you say that?
This was an everyman's refrigerator beer in the late 1960s, Ballantine Triple X. And through convoluted methods, we have Ballantine's yeast that we use. We grow the same hops that they used. We did this because our owner, property owner Richard, and the guy who started the brewery, combat marine in Vietnam, 67-68, and they used to pallet drop beer to these guys, and his group was lucky enough to get Ballantine Triple X dropped to him. So he came in here just after we started brewing for him, and he said, I had this beer called Bally Time in and we said, what? Never heard of this brewery. And after piecing it all together and then showing him some labels for the cans and things, yeah, that one, you know. So we went back, and this brewery had been around since 1841. And there was enough things on their labels, from the first labels up until the end in 70-71, when they got taken over by one of Pabst's acquisitions, and then all their equipment was reconfigured for PBR brewing, and the brands were allowed to die, the Ballantine stuff. But between the labels and newspaper articles and various other things, we were able to piece together what this beer was made from. And the only thing I'm not doing right now is I don't have a water report from 1968 for New Jersey, so I can't exactly recreate their water. But we've had people who've come in here and very familiar with the product, who've told me that we've nailed it. And it's real simple. It's basically a six row malt and a single hop. So it's kind of a commercial smash beer.
Well, it's delicious.
It's different.
I want to say there's a spice character to it, and I want to say cinnamon. But on my palate, maybe it's coming after the root beer. But it's good, and I like the way it is. But I swear that I would say that there is a spice in there. I'm not saying that there is.
No,
but
what it basically is a heavy protein six row barley as a base, and 1923 descendant rhizomes of Brewer's Gold, which is one of the roughest, nastiest, earliest. No character, just bittering, you know, hops that people used in America before the designer hops craze. It comes across with the extra protein and all these things in it as a nearly perfect example of 1967 beer. This stuff was 50 cents a six pack in 1970, tax included. So at one point in time, everybody had some in their refrigerator. It was national distribution. And at that point, they were a 130-year-old brewery. They were the first brewery to make IPAs in the United States. The Ballantine IPA was the first American one. And then Barton, which was never sold, but aged 10 years and then given to everybody in the supply chain down to the grocery store clerks at Christmas.
It's got a ton of character for something that you know, you would think that a beer that would be, you know, the nation's lawnmower beer or whatever, you know, you would characterize it at, you would think that it would be kind of like bland and nondescript, and, you know, but this, so what's the hopping schedule? I mean, how do you get that spiciness in
that? Well, the same way they did.
But we don't know that, Chris.
Well, okay.
I'm assuming there's hops near the end of the boil because, no?
Steam extracted hop oil.
Huh. So is that a commercial product that you get?
Wow.
Yeah. And, wow. And I'm actually learning how to do the extraction process myself. I mean, we're growing the hops. And I do put some of those hops in, not enough to actually give this character, but they didn't either. They were building a basically hopless wort, fermenting it, and then adding hop oil at the end, which gives it a significant impact aroma-wise.
Huh.
And most of that is what tricks you into thinking that there's something more in the beer, because your nose picks up immediately. Before you even taste it, you get this idea of what's gonna hit you. And those were tricks that early brewers used before they had all the various grains and everything else to actually give you those things. But, you know, Brewer's Gold, one of the earliest North American commercial hops, probably if we had American noble hops, that would be that and bouillon, the male and female versions of the same plant, would be the grandfather of them all.
So just hop oil near the end of the boil, or?
In processing. Right.
What?
Yep. Yep.
So there's no hops.
Very little hops in the beer, and hop oil at the end.
So you're essentially dry hopping in the serving vessel with hop oil.
Yep, we use we bright in our half barrels for these, forced carbonation in the half barrels, and we do a complete recirculation system, an inline carbonation system in those, and so that's where we inject the hop oil into the system, and it breaks up and suspends, and it's really quite a neat process. But it does provide a character that hasn't actually been seen in American beer since the mid-70s.
Wow.
And like I said, it's not a beer snob beer. It probably would never win a competition, but it's a...
Oh, I don't know. It's got tons of character. I mean,
it does.
You know, a lot of the, you know, people say, oh, this is our, you know, our entry level beer or our lawnmower beer, or whatever. It's our, you know, sort of American Pilsner. It's like, yeah, that's clean. It's not, you know, there's a ton of, I mean, it's not,
there's a reason it,
the bitterness level is not like IPA level bitterness, but there is a solid bitterness there.
Yes.
But then there's that spice in there as well that makes it really interesting.
And that's mostly the last episode we were talking about the suspended particulate matter giving tastes that you may or may not want in your beer. Mm-hmm. Six row barley has an issue with leaving a lot more protein in the beer, and you can taste it. Mm. And so that has that kind of, it is kind of spicy, but it's not really a spice you'd recognize. It just affects your tongue like a spice would. It excites parts of your tongue. And then with the addition of the aroma of the hops, it leads you to believe that the beer has more complexity than it does. It was one of the neatest little things. And this is the beer that I had to learn how to ranch yeast for, because a sample of the original yeast was super expensive for a little bottle. And so I had to grow this yeast and clean it and wash it and store it and clean it and wash it and store it. And I'm still doing that for this beer. The neat thing about growing yeast is once you get a starter big enough for whatever batch you're pitching, you get six batches that size out of it when it's done. Mm. You can clean it up. It scales. Yeast production scales with beer production. So if I'm making barrel and a half size, then I'll get six starts out of one, you know, and that's kind of neat.
Yeah.
But I've learned how to work with yeast, kind of a crash course, when I got that first sample, I'm like, I can't pay this much every time I want to brew this beer. So I gave myself a real crash course. And my wife, being a microbiologist with 20-some-odd years of lab science experience, she was able to point me to tools to use and proper techniques that I didn't know because I'm not one. And now we've got good cultures of yeast going that we just keep on working with.
Wow.
Well, now we've got a really
dark,
inky,
yes,
black beer.
This is the Irish Cream Stout. And I hope I don't offend anybody here. To bring life into the world in the Judeo-Christian idea, you need three beings. You need a mother, a father, and God. So the idea of creating something as the love child of three happens to go all the way back to the beginning of time. So this is Bailey's, Jameson, and Guinness. The illegitimate love child of Bailey's, Jameson, and Guinness turned in, it's basically a hard stout turned into a milk stout and then aged on Jameson's stave. So you end up with a beer that there's no such thing as an Irish cream stout as a BJCP category, but it just,
yeah,
it was inspired.
It's nice. It's got the milkshakey thing going on, but there's also a vanilla component that I'm assuming is coming from the wood. So,
and if you happen to blend that up with vanilla ice cream, it makes the best actual old-time malt you'll ever have. And it cuts the alcohol down by about 2/3. And, you know, it turns into really nice in the summer.
Yeah.
We do a lot of those.
So talk about the recipe. Talk about the malt bill.
This one is a big percentage of two-row, straight two-row brewer's malt, not pale or anything like that. I add, for a little sweet character, one of my favorite grains, which is Malting Company of Ireland's stout malt. And then darkening goes with crisp pale chocolate, and I don't go down into roasted barleys or black patent. I keep it debittered, Carafa series, Black Prince. And I do tend to make it dark. And it's a fairly big grain bill, because the more dark grains you have in there, the harder it is to meet your original gravity number sometimes. And so we go a little overboard on the recipe grain bill to make sure we can hit our numbers. Not too far, but it's one that strains the kettles a little bit. And then that one has, I believe that one's Lallemand Nottingham as the yeast in it. We make use of a whole lot of yeasts in our brews. But the Nottingham tends to go just where we want it to alcohol-wise and then stop. And it spends a significant amount of time in secondary with the wood. And then it takes a little longer to crash. But that one's worth the extra effort you have to put into.
Yeah, it's nice.
It's the darkest beer I brew. Now, this one is...
None more black. That's a Spinal Tap reference.
Yes. This one is it ties for our most popular beer. And this is the only beer on the entire wall that I take full responsibility for, from recipe development to I brew it myself with no help every time. Because if anything goes wrong with it, it's got to be my fault.
This is a red beer. Yes. And it's a reddish copper color.
It's R.O. Reardon's Irish Red, and it is an Irish Red Ale. It's not like Killian's Irish Red American Lager. We brewed this 2 days after Dolores O'Riordan died. She was the lead singer of the Cranberries pop group, and we just decided that we liked her stuff enough that we wanted to do something everybody was, you know, accusations and speculations and all sorts of things that none of it's really ever been decided, or it's been found but not released to the public. But that's not the point.
Yeah, it's none of our business anyway.
She entertained us a great deal, and so we brewed this beer for her. And she came down to the brewery, and she threw my malt mill across the room, and she did all kinds of weird things. And then we took the beer, the first batch, off site to force carbonate it because we didn't have a cold enough place to do it here. So we went elsewhere, and somebody was throwing bottle caps at my wife's head that didn't have. We'd never heard of the beers. And we didn't have those bottles or those bottle caps. And she knocked the red cap that we usually use right off the 3D printer that I was printing, and pretty much put my printer on the floor. I figure she was trying to say thanks, but she'd only been gone for long enough she hadn't, like, fine-tuned her fine motor skills. Because with what she was able to do, if she knew what she was doing was trying to hurt somebody, it would have been, you know, hurt, but...
So I'm surprised this beer is not named Zombie.
We had kind of thought about that, but we figured we already pushed it far enough.
She's mad enough already.
We didn't know whether she just didn't like reds or anything, but she hasn't made her presence known in that way, shape, or form. And who knows what the real reasons were. There might be pigs caught up in electrical cords or whatever. But it's really kind of a neat thing to think that the whole thing went down with Dolores present for the first brewing of her beers.
Makes a good story.
It does.
Now it's nice and malty. It's clear and clean as a whistle. It's got a Bocky character to it. You know, the grain bill to me, I don't know what the proper adjective is, but it reminds me of a nice, well-made Bock.
Of a Bock. And this one right now is at 5.7. And again, I sourced the grain from this from Ireland, Malting Company of Ireland. I wanted to make an authentic Irish red. I wanted to use what guys over there would use, and, you know, that's... Heck, it's there, you know. And two handfuls of darkening grains just to get the color where I wanted it. It's, again, kind of a single malt grain bill on it, but the difference between Malting Company of Ireland's pale and anybody else's pale is like the difference between Grape Nuts and Fruit Loops. It's amazing for being the same treatment. It's a southern... Irish springtime seaside grown grain, so it's plenty of sun, plenty of water, the kernels get huge. It's just a beautiful grain to brew with for a beer like this. You could substitute, you know, any kind of pale and come up with a different beer, but this one is just what I wanted it to be, and it's got, again, Lallemand yeast in it. I use East Kent Goldings and Fuggle. I'm trying to keep to only the ingredients that would have been used in the style. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that I like to explain it this way. A lot of brewers, being kind of bored and wanting to push the envelope to see if they can bring market share to them, have been going to the outskirts of brewing and beyond and continuing to invent out here, but they keep leaving this big hole in the middle where beer goes. And we've got recipes sourcing from as far back as 1780 with our IPAs, our base IPA recipe. And it's not an IPA that people would think of. It's a real, put it in a barrel, no refrigeration, on a ship, send it from England to India. So it's high malt, high hops, high alcohol, and nobody wanted this modern IPA experience. Those British soldiers didn't. They wanted beer. And so we make an IPA that's 82 IBUs and doesn't taste like it, you know, because it is so balanced and so heavy on everything else. So this is kind of where we go with all of the stuff that we're working with. Traditional, as close to possible to beers that people loved for decades, and then they got supplanted. Mm-hmm. If you're an artist, you find purple, you don't throw blue and red away. You know, it's like, wow, purple, I'm going to do everything in purple. No, blue and red still have their place. You know, don't throw it away. Use all three. And so many of our beers have gotten lost. Like our English Dark Mild, it got lost in the IPA craze because ESBs came from Dark Milds, and then the IPAs came from ESBs, and you can't find a Dark Mild hardly anywhere anymore. And we're brewing a 1920s-style Dark Mild. And it's from those roots. People love these beers for decades, and there's no reason why they won't love them now. They're good beers.
We haven't talked about your system. You've got the gluten-free system for Dark Hills sealed off.
Mm-hmm. And
then
the whole room is not even connected by ductwork in here. And we draw all our air and everything else in from outside. We do all grinding in that room for the gluten-free grains, all crushing. If I have to go in there and take something, if I absolutely need a piece of tubing, or it comes out, it never goes back in. Wow. I have to buy the parts and build another, you know, brand new, absolutely clean one and put it back. So keep my hands off of most of the stuff in there, because sometimes it's real easy to say, I need a spoon. Mm-hmm. I need another wooden paddle. Nope, I don't want to have to be at my shop building another wooden paddle for hours.
So talk about the Whistling Springs side.
I decided that I really wanted to move away from gas, because when I started here, I was working on direct fire. So I did some research into Herm's heat exchange recirculating mash systems, and found that was the way I wanted to go with it. So I designed the controller in our system and built it for us to use here. It's a barrel and a half using Kegco kettles, and it's basically a three kettle system. I've got the hot liquor tank, which is 13,000 watts of heating power, and a 100-foot stainless steel heat exchanger coil. Then I've got my mash tun, which is no heat, just a false bottom and a top port and a bottom port, and then another 13,000-watt boil kettle on the far side. I use two 40-plate counterflow plate chillers. Mm. And we cool this with water from the spring on site. It's always cold. And I can drop 45 gallons in 40 minutes from 100 to 18.
Wow.
I use...
Again, Celsius.
Yes. Sorry.
That's all right. Just to clarify.
And I use chugger pumps. I use one Run Dry Protect. And I use one old school pump that I've had for a long time, because that's just sparge water and recirculation. It doesn't ever run dry, but the one that I use to transfer things around between stuff, it's one of the new Run Dry inline chuggers. But I've kind of designed and built the whole system from the ground up.
A home brewer would recognize it, only it's on a bigger scale.
Exactly. And I'm really, if I have to do anything, I'll use steam infusion and a big Herm system, even when I get 20 barrel. Mm-hmm. I really believe in the infinite fine control you can get by controlling the water on the other side of your exchanger coil. There's nothing that I've found that's as repeatable. Huh. It allows me to build these beers consistently. Not so much like a craft brewer that has wide variety between batch and batch and batch, but it lets me kind of nail the beer every time. Now, if I'm doing something like the one I just put in the fermenter 2 days ago, my big wheat, dark wheat Doppelbock, I'm still pulling out gas and extra pots and for the decoctions and and you know that at that point it looks like any home brewer's garage. You've got people running around, thermometers being jammed down into things, timers going off that you can't hit the button on, and everything's going wrong and stuff spitting everywhere. it was an interesting day. But yeah, most of the time homebrewers would recognize a brew day of mine. It's just on a slightly bigger scale. Now, what you got here?
Now I'm sipping the last beer, and it's very light.
Yes.
And it's I take it this one was not triple decocted.
No. No, this is the second in our line of keto friendly beers. This we call Monks on a Diet, and it's a hybrid. Glutinous beer with a lot of gluten-free technology and ingredients put in it to keep the carb counts low and the body feel and that up. It's a Belgian wit. It's got bitter orange and coriander. You got to be real careful, especially with the coriander, that you don't overpower what grain flavor you've got. But we built this. We have a Belgian pale keto and a Belgian wit keto now. We've got several more that we're working on the recipes for, because we want to have, as well as a line of gluten-free beers, we want this side to have a special line of keto-friendly, less than 4 carbs in a 12-ounce glass. And that was the one that you had. Now, I don't know if it made it into last week's podcast, but you did ask for a sample of something, so I'm going to add 2 samples to your... to what you've got here.
Okay.
The first one is going to be the one you asked for.
It'll be the Goza. Now, the Monks on a Diet is very nice, very drinkable, very light. You said something about dirt road bicyclists coming through here or something like that. They would enjoy something like that.
Absolutely.
That's very nice.
That's my lunch and pizza beer here. being here, I get to drink whatever I'm feel like pulling off the tap. Now, this is our Goza, and it's kind of like a training wheels Goza. It is for people who are just trying to get used to the idea of an intentionally soured beer. And it doesn't have anything like fruit in it or anything else. It's just a simple, straightforward Goza, more along the flavor profile of a Berliner Weisse, actually. But with the salt and everything else that was in it, it's actually a Goza. It just kind of crosses taste boundaries. Goes real well with Woodruff syrup, raspberry, lemon syrup. During the summers, we usually have those 3 syrups available to us. The guys down at Pink House Alchemy, they create some really neat syrups. So we don't have to. But again, local source.
This is very nice. It's for my palate. You know, I'm used to really sour and tart beers. It is mildly tart for my scale, and the salt, you can taste it, but it's not like in your face. It's very nicely balanced and very drinkable. It's not an odd, you know, normal beer drinker wouldn't drink that and say, "Ooh, this is odd." You know, it's nice. It's nicely. Nicely balanced.
We have a lot of folks who come out here who came from PBR and Mick Ultra in cans, and they come in here to look at experiencing a little more in the beer world. And so we have a lot of things that go kind of overboard, but we also have some very simple things that can bring people into the idea of this is what craft beer can be, and it's not as scary as you think it might be. It's just an opportunity to add more to what you do. This is one of the more overboard beers.
Yeah, this the roast just jumps out at my nose. And again, to reassure everybody, I'm having lots of samples, but I doubt if you put all the samples together that you would get a whole beer.
You don't have a pint.
So we're being responsible here.
Yep, it's 1-ounce sample cups, and... Now, this one is our Black Ops Cascadian Dark IPA.
Wow.
Wow. Boy, that's super roasty, and the hops come across nicely. It's big and chewy. But it's only 5%.
This is still one. This one came from the fertile mind of one of our regular customers and our house musician, Joe Stanley. He's a guitar player. He sings and entertains here. He said, I want something like my heart, dark, cold, black.
And bitter.
Bitter. And so we took our regular IPA recipe and darkened it significantly and kept the hops level the same. This is still an 82-83 IBU beer. And we've been kind of messing with the alcohol level because we still want to have it high hops, high malt forward, really roasty, really dark.
But it's super drinkable, though.
Again, I'm not an IPA drinker, but I do like hops. I like hops as a properly added adjunct. I like it as spice, not base, you know. I've had people come in here saying, why don't you have 4 or 5 IPAs on tap? It's because you can go anywhere in town and find 4 or 5 IPAs on tap.
Or some 10 minutes away.
We're giving you things you won't find other places. And we have our 3 IPAs, 2 of which are now on tap. We're almost out of our fall IPA, which is the Man Grapes. And yes, every brewery has to have one because then you don't have to have more than one.
So you got to tell me how you dark, what elements that you used, what ingredients that you used to darken up this beer, because it is nice and roasty and the roast just jumps right out at you.
At that point, we are using roasted barley, black patent, and dark chocolate. We're using, and next one I'm going to throw some 450 Lovibond Midnight Wheat in it as well. I mean, we're getting down there into the 300-400L roasts, and a significant amount of it, because the idea was, let's make this dark.
But the roastiness doesn't clash with the bitterness, though.
No. And we can go significantly roasty before we overpower the hops, because at 82 IBU. Now, this is...
Okay. Last beer.
Right. This is Man Grapes IPA. This is our fruited version of our Made in the Shade, which is our summertime version of the Black Ops. The Black Ops are a winner.
Ooh.
Mango and grapefruit.
Wow. Yeah.
Now,
super fruity.
Since you're not going to get to see it, you might as well imagine it. It took 4 grocery stores to find the proper combination that I could take a picture to Photoshop the label that's going on this thing when it goes in. I mean, 2 grapefruits is easy, but the perfect mango, finding it, took 4 grocery stores. And now you can imagine how these all go together for the label. Because we're not trying to fool anybody when we called it Man Grapes IPA. This is one where you're going to be walking through the store and you're going to stop for a second and shake your head and say, I did not just see that on the label of a beer. Yes, I did.
It's a family show, Chris.
Yeah, because in all honesty, it has been shown that if somebody picks up a beer, there's about a 70% chance it's going in the shopping cart. And really, brand recognition is what we're after, with one beer drawing the eye, and then look for the logo, and then look around on the shelves and see what else is from us. Every brewery needs to have one beer that's just guys, you know, and then the rest of them draw energy from the connection made with that very first beer.
So did you use the pasteurization technique on this one, and
yes,
then and then back sweeten with the fruit?
Only with the grapefruit.
Huh.
And the grapefruit comes from our tree, which is grown in Texas. We have family down there, and we brought our grapefruit trees down there, and so we go down there and we load up a truck bed of grapefruit and bring it up here and process the juice and store it. So we're using our own grapefruits on that. We're not using our own mangoes. We don't grow our own mangoes. Nobody around here that I know of grows mangoes. And mango is kind of a hard thing to get out. But that's why it ends up at the end of secondary, so that the action of the beer can kind of pull stuff out of just this buttery block of stuff. You know, you don't just squeeze it and get juice out of it. And then we pasteurize that, and then we add the grapefruit. So most of the time when we can get decent clear juice, we'll pasteurize and use it. When it's not going to go easily, persimmon, mango, some melons like you know, cantaloupes and honeydews and things like that, those things you have to smash them and boil them and then strain them and everything else. We let the beers work on them a little bit to do their thing. But if we can get a good solid juice, we like to leave all the character of the juice. I'm not trying to make a wine here where you're trying to reduce certain characters of the fruit. If I say I've got blueberries in a thing, I want you to taste blueberries. That's the point of it.
Well, it's super good, and it's been quite a chat. It's been a long time since I've had a two-parter, and I'm glad that we took the time to develop time and energy and conversation to both sides. I appreciate it. If you're north of, just north of Pea Ridge, Arkansas,
in Jacket,
Missouri, just go to the website and there's instruction. You're put it in Waze. Waze knows where Whistling Springs is, Whistling Springs Brewery, and there's signs on the highway that are easy to find. So come and find Chris and Lee, and taste what they've been doing. I appreciate you taking the time, Chris.
Well, thank you, and thanks to everybody for spending the time listening.
Thanks again to Chris. Dark Hills and Whistling Springs have a very cool tap room, and it is in the country. But it doesn't take long to get there from busy Northwest Arkansas. I just love the variety of local beers that we have access to nowadays. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. And thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies are always coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. It's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.